an incompetent king with delusions of grandeur, an inward-looking city driven by a mixture of pride, hubris and fear to cling to their traditional rights, a nation teetering between a bankrupt central government and oligarchs seeking to expand their power, a ruthless world without safety nets where the poor starved, the sick died, and conflict seemed endemic. The year is 1251. The location, the City of London. The largest town in England, filled with thousands of residents, crammed within its crowded, noisy and fetid streets behind its tall but decaying walls. It was a place of incredible life and vibrancy. Like today, it was a home of the very rich and also the destitute. A place of bankers and merchants, of tradesmen and dock workers, of carpenters and butchers, but above all, it was a place of politics. And the politics was predicated upon one simple idea. London had rights. These rights and privileges they had extracted and bought over the many centuries before this time. They'd been conceived of in the reigns of ancient kings like Æthelred, Undred, Harold Harfoot, and Edward the Confessor. But these had been codified without definition in a few short lines written on a scrap of paper by William the Conqueror. His son, Henry I, had granted London their first detailed charter, codifying these privileges. And he offered this, seeking London's support for his daughter Matilda. They'd not given her their support, but rather had sided with King Stephen, who granted them extended powers and actually declared the city a self-governing commune. But from this zenith, the city had retreated in the face of the rather ferocious Henry II, still retaining some rights. And then towards the end of his reign, they'd been granted their first podestra, their first mayor of the city. These liberties, hard won, had remained. And attempts to curtail them by Henry's younger son, John, had seen the city support radical barons, in fact, possibly instigated them to cause the Barons' War, and by extension, the Magna Carta, a document for the whole nation who had London's very grubby fingerprints all over it. But for the last few decades, John's son, Henry III, had been eroding these rights. Over the last few episodes, we have seen the king remove the liberties of London frequently, evoking the crown's nominal power to run its main city time and again, and London would only regain its powers of self-determination after conceding large amounts of cash to this perfidious king. Things were building towards a crisis. A great storm was coming. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is the story of London. An attempt to try and tell the epic, exciting, intense and colourful tale of the city as a single narrative. We have reached chapter 94 and gaze at a city caught up in events beyond their control. The king and London were on a collision course and nothing seemed capable of stopping it. Ominous thunder can be heard in the distance, getting closer. Welcome then to chapter 94 of the story, A Gathering Storm. We begin this episode with a moment of whimsy. We begin with a wild animal. As you may remember from previous episodes, the Tower of London was the home of a small menagerie. I mentioned in a previous chapter the arrival of three leopards there, presented by the Holy Roman Emperor to the King of England. They're called leopards, but several historians insist they were actually lions. But either way, large cats, and they needed to be cared for and fed. The budget for this had been extracted from Henry III, but the king, with typical parsimonious inclinations, eventually passed these expenses onto the duties of the sheriffs of London. And around 1250 or 1251, King Henry III was given a new present by King Hakon of Norway, a bear. A bear described as being very pale or even white, which makes it sound like a polar bear. We can't be sure for certain, but it probably was. Norse travellers had written about encounters with white bears in their sagas, and it has to be said that King Haakon was an incredibly expansionist monarch who had recently brought Iceland and Greenland under Norwegian control. So an errant polar bear being found in those regions and then being used as a gift to the English king sounds right up his street. Therefore, the bear and his handler ended up at the Tower of London. Once again, the sheriffs of the city had to provide subsistence for the beast, but the rate they were set at was 4 sous a day, which, to be honest, could barely cover the costs of the handler, and would certainly not feed an adult polar bear. Indeed, Henry III clearly wished for this bear to be rather self-sufficient in providing for itself. The result was that London sheriffs were instructed to create a stout metal muzzle and chain to allow its Norwegian handler lead the bear out of its enclosure in the Tower of London and down to the River Thames. Here the handler would oversee as the bear would wash and feed itself as best it could in the river. And this turned heads. Londoners seemed to have delighted at the prospect of a daily ritual of a large white bear and its foreign handler leading it down to the river to see it hunt. Alas, we don't know if it had a name, nor the name of the handler who would oversee this and put the muzzle on and off again. It should be noted that the poor sheriffs who had this responsibility that year were Lawrence de Frowick and Nicholas Batt. Nicholas Batt, the former mayor and former sheriff of the city, whose successive terms of sheriff had caused the city to clash with the king. Nicholas Batt, whose claim to fame as mayor may have been to happily obey the king and seize innocent priests from London churches and chain them up in the Tower of London. Henry III's yes man. Hey, this is my podcast, and therefore this is my version of events, and I must admit, I could be wrong about Nicholas Batt. Maybe he wasn't a dodgy fellow who was utterly in the king's pocket. Maybe him being linked to behind-the-scenes machinations within the city and dodgy stuff is, well, unfair of me. Maybe Nicholas Batt was a perfectly fine city official, and when he held office, we do not see enemies of the king being arrested and put on trial on dodgy charges, and to suggest that is just unfair of me, and I'm drawing conclusions where none should be. I'll take that. Anyway, the oddest thing happened in 1251 when he was sheriff. Apparently, there was a huge trial of some of the bigger names in London, accused of vague crimes and brought before the king's justicars in the Tower of London. Wow, that is a coincidence. Yeah. Basically, what we read is that in the records of Theodmar, who doesn't really record any court cases, except where they're related to the relationship between London and the Crown, he suddenly mentions a court case at the Tower during which 6 Londoners from traditional Eshevin families, such as the Durantes and the Lepepperers, are accused of a non-specific crime, but they're brought up on serious charges and manage to clear their name. It should also be said that another called John de Clercq, quote, failed in making his law and was therefore condemned to death, unquote. So we don't know exactly what's going on, but my reading of this, and I could be wrong, is that the continuing tensions between London and the Crown were manifesting itself in intrigues in the city itself, between those elements who were supportive of the traditional status quo, who were focused on defending the liberties and rights of London, as opposed to those who supported the real politic of the era, who were profiting from the increased influence of foreign merchants, and who supported the king's right to run everything, and that it just flared up. That there was an attempt at a pogrom of sorts, some kind of mass accusation, and that 7 members of the city had been brought up on serious charges. It's worth remembering the case of Constantine Fintzanov, which we discussed back in chapter 87. There, a former sheriff of London openly confessed to issuing the battle cry of Prince Louis, the French prince who London had backed over Henry III to hold the throne. And it's worth keeping in mind that Nicholas Batt, as mayor, had thrown people into the Tower of London at the king's behest, as I discussed back in chapter 91. So, as it was, this matter was resolved, but 6 out of these 7 big names were cleared. And to further support the idea that there was some kind of internal faction going on, it's also noticeable that the mayor that year was Adam de Basing. Adam was the son of Solomon de Basing. If you can remember, Solomon de Basing had been mayor during the First Barons' War. He was the man who took over the position of mayor after Jacob Alderman, the then mayor, either died suddenly in office, as some sources say, or was deposed from office, as other sources say, and I advocate. Solomon Debasing's had been followed by Solo the Mercer, and Solomon had clearly seemed to be in the pro-Louis camp that had staged the purge of the city, which we covered back in chapter 86. Adam Debasing's, however, was somewhat different from his father. He was a draper, and the drapers at this time were men making money importing and exporting Flemish goods, and do seem to be benefiting from the increased power and influence of foreign merchants. And said foreign merchants operated under the king's protection. And one could suggest that when we say Adam Debasing was a draper, we could use it as shorthand to suggest Adam Debasing was a mayor who sided with the crown in political fights. And maybe the arrests and trial of these seven men in the tower are indicative of there being a pro-crown element gaining control of the city and trying to purge some opposition that year. Of course, I'd need a bit more evidence to suggest that Adam Debasing was so in with King Henry III to have any possibility of this wild speculation of mine having any credence. You know, like Henry III granting Adam Debasing possession of a big slab of London territory. Quote, certain houses and aldermanry and in Milk Street, the advowson of the Church of Basing's Hall, and other liberties and privileges, unquote. So yeah, apparently the Debasings and Adam gained a whole small section of London from Henry III. We could ask why, and I'm just looking at that's court cases. Baldwin's account of the history of London, written in 1773, stated that this region actually became a ward of London, or a mini ward, known as Basingshaw Ward. His account says, quote, this small ward is bounded on the east and south by Coleman Street Ward, on the north by Cripplegate Ward, and on the west by Cripplegate and Cheap Wards. It consists only of Basinghall Street, with the courts and avenues leading into it, which are well built and inhabited, unquote. So yeah, Adam Debasing is basically me given his own ward in London, which today is just one street, Basinghall Street. But this is why I believe there is continued tension between the two sides, and maybe I'm wrong about how intense it all seems, but if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, I think personally it's a very hostile internal political duck. Still, 12:51 passed quietly, best remembered for the five incredibly hot days between June 24th and June 29th, and we enter 12:52. This started relatively quietly for London, with the new mayor, John Turlison, taking office, and events elsewhere now begin to take over. Over the last few episodes, I've been trying not to allow national events dominate the narrative of what was happening in London, but we do need to talk about events elsewhere. A few years previously, there had been a rebellion in Gascony. This part of southern France was the last part of the territory of the mighty Plantagenet family, all that remained of the vast empire of Henry II. And while Henry III had always dreamed of replicating his grandfather's holdings, his perennial lack of cash, coupled with his overall incompetence, meant that this was never going to happen. It was all he could do to hold on to Gascony, and it had been the source of endless, highly expensive campaigns to try and pacify it. Until he sent his brother-in-law, Simon de Montfort, or to do the correct pronunciation of the time, Simon de Montfort, down to Gascony to run it on his behalf. And at first, that had been an amazing move. De Montfort had managed to pacify rebellious lords and maintained actually quite a strong grip on power. But before long, this regime had run short of money and things changed. The Gascon nobility refused to submit to De Montfort, and he decided that the suffering would continue until morale and loyalty improved. So he confiscated land, he destroyed buildings, and showing just how vicious Simon de Montfort could be, he cut down vines in a wine-producing region, destroying vines. Mon Dieu! And so by 1252, Gascony was now in total uproar. And Henry supposedly was going to visit him to try and pacify it. And here is where differing sources explain the events over the next few years in a slightly differing order. For the purpose of this podcast, I'm going to reconstruct events as they happen, but within the framework of the narrative story I'm telling. So I'll just alert you, dear listener, that the exact sequence of these events happening may be open to debate. But as far as we can tell, Henry III needed to sort out the mess in Gascony. As such, just before he left, quote, the whole community of London was assembled in the churchyard of Westminster, where his lordship the king took leave of them, saying he was about to cross over into Gascon, and gave orders that all the persons in the city should meet together on the Sunday following at St. Paul's Cross in the presence of those he should send thither, and there make oath of fealty to Sir Edward, his son, and to his queen, to whose charge he was about to commit his kingdom, unquote. So the king was leaving. He wanted everybody in London to swear allegiance to him, his heir, and also to the queen, because the queen would be in charge while he's gone. It should also be added that, quote, at the same time, the king, by a new charter, confirmed unto the citizens of London all their franchises, laws, and customs, and also those which they had in the time of King Henry I, both used and disused, and further granted that £7 sterling should be allowed yearly to the sheriffs and their firm for the liberty of St. Paul Church, and that the mayor, who was wont to be presented to the king only, whenever in England he might be, should in future be presented to the barons of the Exchequer at Westminster, in case the king should not be in London at the time when the mayor was elected, unquote. So, wow, this is the king giving some major concessions here. First of all, this new charter he's giving London, it confirms the rights of the charter given by Henry I, and that's really important. Remember, the charter and rights given by Henry I, the coronation charter and also the London charter he issued later, this was the basis for the original First Barons' War, London joining the barons' side. And he's giving them both the bits that are recognised, both used and disused, so the bits that have sort of fallen by the wayside. This is a massive concession. And he's also allowing the mayor turn up just to Westminster to present himself and not have to travel to find the king. Of course, the king never gave such concessions out of the generosity of his heart. As record said, quote, it should also be known that the citizens then gave unto his lordship the king 500 marks for obtaining that charter, unquote. Ah, yes, indeed. So, yes, Henry III gave them a piece of paper that says, look, these are all your rights and they can't be infringed. And it just so happened that he did it when he needed a big bunch of silver in order to be able to go to Gascony. Anyway, the affairs in Gascony did much to sour relationships between de Montfort and the king, with their personal acrimony and bitterness just rising now to the surface. And King Henry was reported to have said to his brother-in-law, quote, I never repented of any act so much as I now repent of ever having permitted you to enter England, or to hold any land or honours in that country, in which you have fattened so as to kick against my authority, unquote. But this declining relationship between the king and his brother-in-law was simply one facet of a multifaceted series of crises the king was facing everywhere. King Henry's grand dreams of restoring the Grand Plantagenet patrimony, rejoining Normandy, Anjou and Aquitaine to the English crown in some kind of English reconquista, was something he desperately wanted, but was clear to everyone that this was an ambition that lay far beyond his meagre budget. Over in France, Louis IX was able to pay 150,000 livres for what was supposedly the crown of thorns. He was able to raise over 1 million livres for his crusade. Yet here, there's King Henry III struggling to raise enough funds to launch small-scale military operations to sail across the Channel every 4 or 5 years. And plain English, compared to his rival kings across Europe, and above all, compared to his ancestors, Henry III was broke ass. His estates and the profits gained from the duties of government, justice and trade were enough to allow him run his household. Indeed, for all his lavishness, Henry III was often able to manage a relatively fiscally stable household, provided he was at peace. Because truth be told, it always fell apart financially when he needed to fund a war. And it was never strong enough to fund foreign expeditions. Yet paradoxically, Henry III dreamed endlessly of foreign conquests. He'd worked hard to cultivate the image of a free-spending prince whose generosity brought bountiful reward, and he spent heavily on his architectural projects as well as collecting art and jewels, which were very useful to collect because he could pawn them later. And it's also said he stockpiled gold in his personal chambers, supposedly sleeping amongst stacks of small ingots and sheafs of gold leaf. But The basic financial reality was that he could not generate enough cash to pay for military expeditions. So he was forced to go elsewhere to seek for these funds. Often he took out loans, always to French and Italian merchants, but these needed repaying, and so they were not a good source of revenue. Ad hoc tactics for revenue generation, including fleecing the Jewish residents of this country. But in truth, the only real alternative was gaining money from his richest nobles. Ever since the mid-1220s, a principle of quid pro quo had started between the king and his major nobility. He would grant them political concessions in exchange for funds and taxes. By the late 1240s, this quid pro quo had evolved into an ongoing relationship in which the great men of England had begun to see these meetings with the king as a legitimate and customary venue during which they were free to voice their critiques of government policy. These meetings then gained a formal name when in 1236, Henry III adjourned a law case to this body, which is referred to in the legal documents as the Parliament. This is its origins. And we'd seen that this early Parliament had, within a decade, began using its authorities to judge and direct state policy. Between 1248 and 1249, four of these earliest Parliaments refused Henry a grant of tax which would have allowed him turned Simon de Montfort's stewardship of Gascony into a campaign of conquest. These nobles realised that as long as the king needed money, he had to listen to them, and they used these meetings to complain about widespread corruption in local government, for example. Faced with stubborn resistance to taxation from his barons without having to make concessions, Henry turned to other less regulated sources of income. He focused upon revenue streams that targeted the pockets of his knights and lower-born subjects. And this is where London fits into all of this. I remember saying back in chapter 52 how my mentality is always to follow the money to get to the heart of anything going on in the past. And here is a perfect example. I can talk endlessly about Henry's relationship with London being driven by memories of their resistance to him when he came to the throne. And London was all about defending their traditional rights. But behind all of that, Henry III needed cash, and London could provide it, and he would do whatever he needed to milk it. And as I've shown before, Henry III liked to use the legal system to extract cash. His travelling royal courts began to concentrate more heavily than ever on milking the profits of justice. Meanwhile, his sheriffs, increasingly becoming foreign-born, centrally appointed officials parachuted into the shires of England to oversee royal government, began to become noticeably more rapacious in their efforts to raise cash. Henry that would grant multiple chivalries to his followers, leading them to press heavily for money on people to whom they were neither connected nor accountable. And in this respect, London's troubles were merely part of a nationwide series of issues. By 1253, we see the city of London filled with local affairs and news. For example, arriving from Gascony came an order of monks from Italy, calling themselves the Friar Hermits of St. Augustine of Hippo, and the Earl of Hereford and Essex granted them land just inside the walls of the city, on the west side of Old Broad Street, where they could build a priory. In time, they became known to Londoners simply as the Austin Friars. Also, 1253 saw a market being established over in the nearby town of West Ham, to be held every Tuesday with an annual fair held every July. And added to this, around, quote, the 10th day of October, the water of the Thames rose to a greater height than it ever had done in our times, unquote. Given that a few years previous we had a flood south of the river that had extended 6 miles, one wonders just how bad this one was to get that sentence written about it. However, floods aside, the big political news for London that year was the election of Nicholas Batt to mayor. Yep, Mr. Batt is back again. And do we see mass arrests of political opponents? No, thankfully not. Indeed, Batt's return to office saw he, quote, was presented to the barons of the Exchequer at Westminster and sworn and admitted in the manner granted to the citizens by the charter of his lordship the king, unquote. So that new rule seems to have worked. This new charter was brilliant. Indeed, in 1253, the only controversial issue in this term of office appears to have been, quote, "About the season of Lent, the sheriffs of Middlesex, by precept of his lordship the king, caused all the weirs to be destroyed that stood in the Thames towards the west, and at this time many nets, which were injurious, were burnt in Westcheap. Afterwards, and before Pentecost, the sheriffs of London, seeing that the water of the Thames pertains unto London, and by precept of this the lordship the king, destroyed all other weirs from London to the sea." Unquote. Now, this is about an issue that will raise its head from time to time, the right to fish on the River Thames. And remember, fishing in the river was not done with men with rods, but by constructing large fish weirs where nets set were across large areas of the river. At the time, it was felt that nets with small holes were dangerous, as smaller, younger fish were caught up in the catch, and that depleted the fish stock. And this, coupled with the rights long being a source of legal issues, and you may remember I once detailed a heck of a case over the right to fish in the river all the way back in chapter 63, and the whole thing seems to have come up again. The image of these fish nets being gathered together and publicly burned on Cheapside does suggest this was all done at the behest of London's residents, possibly to the sounds of cheers and children laughing. Now, I will say, it should be noted that some sources say that the mayor of London in 1253 was a man called Nicholas de la Beche. But I think that is confusion, mistaking a name of a person who was a constable of the Tower of London many years later. Or that Nicholas Batt was shortened for de la Beche. But whatever. There's also confusion over the name Gerald Batt and Nicholas Batt. The mayor in 1240, his name is Gerald Batt, and the career of Nicholas Batt as Sheriff of London began in 1244. I have maintained through all these episodes that Gerald Batt and Nicholas Batt were the same man, which would then say his mayoralty in 1253 is his second term in office. However, if we accept that Gerald Batt in 1240 was the brother or father of Nicholas Batt and a separate person, then what we have is not a single yes man serving the king, but two of them. Gerald being the man who threw a churchman from St. Paul's into the tower at the king's behest and caused an almighty row, and Nicholas being the one who 4 years later the king had kept sheriff for too long and caused issues, and he was also sheriff when there was a bunch of arrests, which I mentioned at the start of this one. So, again, I could be doing Mayor Batt, singular or plural, a disservice. And maybe he isn't a dodgy character or characters, any which way you look at it, or maybe I'm hitting the nail on the head. Moving on. 1254 is notable for another wild animal arriving at the Tower of London. This time, an elephant. A genuinely amazing sight for Londoners. The beast was a gift from King Louis IX of France and was kept in the Tower of London. And yet, the sheriffs were expected to bear the cost for it, which was about £22 to construct a massive house for the creature, 20 feet by 40 feet apparently. But yeah, there's an elephant and a polar bear, and maybe three lions. The Tower of London's getting really exotic. And then in 1254, we have Ralph Hardell becoming the mayor, and following the protocols established the year before, which said he just presented himself to the barons of the Exchequer in Westminster, quote, "The citizens, bringing with them their new charter, presented him to said barons, who would not admit him without writ of his lordship the king, saying that the mayor in the preceding year was not admitted by reasons of the new charter, but by assent of her ladyship the queen, then at Westminster, to whose custody the kingdom had been entrusted," unquote. Look, again, I'm not saying Nicholas Batt was favoured by the king, but it's one rule for one guy and one rule for everyone else, it seems. And usually, whenever there's some kind of technical problem, there's usually an underlying row behind it. And guess what? There was. Quote, "Immediately after this, the barons showed a writ of his lordship the king, by which precept was given to them that they should take the city into the king's hands, for non-observant in the city of the assize of bread and ale. And although the citizens ought not to be molested for such a default as this, but only the sheriffs if convicted thereof, still the city was taken into the king's hands, and delivered into the custody of John de Guisors, the said John being sworn before the barons, after which the clerks and all the sergeants of the sheriffs, and also the wardens of the gates, the Thames and the jail, there were sworn," unquote. So, we're back to London having its liberties removed. And this time, because they didn't punish bakers for making low-quality bread or brewers for making low-quality ale harshly enough. And what we see there, by the way, is a wonderful example of what happens when we say they took the liberties of the city away from it, because it meant that the clerks working in Guildhall, the sergeants who enforced and worked for the sheriffs, the wardens of the city gates, the wardens of the River Thames, and the wardens of the city jails are the people who work for these officials. But it must be understood, the king's taking the liberties of London when he's not even in the country. He's over in Gascony in France right now, currently marrying Prince Edward to a Spanish princess. But it is worth noting that the records say, quote, all of this had been discussed in Parliament, unquote. So why was this early Parliament siding against London? Well, take on board that when I suggest Nicholas Batt was mayor and that was indicative of London being split between factions and this was causing an underlying political instability in the city, it doesn't just come from my imagination, it comes from lines. Which, for example, this line that says the reason behind Parliament being involved in this case was, quote, because the citizens being divided amongst themselves would not appear there before Earl Richard, as they'd promised him, to put an end to a matter on which they had frequently entreated him before, unquote. So yeah, it does seem to be this feedback loop where internal conflicts of the city were being reflected in the powers that be. Any which way, it wasn't just the king who was suspending the liberties of London. Now the king's brother was doing it in the name of Henry III. And of course, there was a solution to this, which was, as always, cash. We read that, quote, the citizens of Westminster made fine to the said Earl before the council of his lordship the king in the sum of 600 marks, whereupon all claims were remitted on account of the exchange and the mayor and the sheriffs were restored to their bailiwicks, unquote. As one 18th century historian summed up all of this, quote, provided Henry could get money from the citizens, he would either give them a confirmation of their liberties or take the liberty to set them aside, which contradictory conduct rendered his grant of charters a mere joke, unquote. And this is just never-ending. We read also that year that the mayor and sheriffs were committed to the Marshalsea prison, supposedly in arrears for payments to the king during his trip to France, and that, quote, upon his return from whence, the Londoners, as usual, sent a deputation to congratulate him upon his safe arrival and to present him with the sum of £100, as was customary on such occasions. Henry, instead of thanking them, said it was no more than his due, and that if they would merit his thanks, they must enlarge their present. The citizens presented him with a valuable piece of plate of exquisite workmanship, which pacified him for the present, unquote. Where's my presents, London? Give me my presents, London. Give me my presents now, London. And then, on top of all of this that year, along came the matter of John Gate. John Gate was a convicted murderer who has been held in Newgate Prison awaiting his execution for the killing of a prior who was supposedly related to the Queen. And then John Gate somehow managed to escape. King Henry hit the roof. And, quote, the king sent for the mayor and the sheriffs of the Tower of London and, according to his usual justice, demanded of the city as an atonement for the crime no less than the sum of 3,000 marks. To give sanction to this demand, he degraded both the sheriffs and, because the citizens did not pay that enormous sum immediately down, he caused many of the chief of them to be seized and clapped up in prison, unquote. Wow. And we read at the time, the records from London confirm this. Quote, the sheriffs were taken and delivered to the marshal of the King's Court. On the morrow, were imprisoned in the Tower of London, where they remained a month and more. Afterwards, for many reasons shown to the King, the sheriffs were released on surety of the mayor. But the King, being moved to anger beyond measure at such escape, would not allow the sheriffs to remain in office. Wherefore, the citizens removed them and elected others, unquote. So they're firing people, they're jailing people, he's demanding money. This row carried from 1254 into 1255. The king demanding this huge amount of cash. William Hardell was re-elected mayor, possibly being seen as a little bit of continuity in dealing with him. And then the mayor's power was suspended again as, quote, the king took the city into his hand because the citizens, who had been repeatedly pressed for the queen's gold, would not agree to pay it, and so the city remained in the hands of the treasurer to whom the king had entrusted it, unquote. Eventually, the massive fine was raised and paid round about November the 11th, quote, on which day, by writ of his lordship the king, the city was restored to the citizens in accordance with their request, unquote. While this endless series of political rows rolled all about them, London was still meant to be the central focus of pomp and circumstance in the country. That June, we read, quote, the sister of the King of Spain, wife of Sir Edward, eldest son of his lordship the king, came to London, and a countless multitude of bishops, earls, barons, knights, and citizens went forth from the city to meet her, and also his lordship the king in person, the city of London being most notably tapestried and arrayed, unquote. So yeah, future Queen of England's turning up, let's break out all the bunting. And later that August, the tapestries and buntings came out again as the King and Queen of Scotland came on a royal visit. And behind all this grandeur, London also witnessed some more gruesome spectacles. That year, 92 Jews had been arrested up in Lincoln, completely falsely accused of the ritual murder of a local boy, this being one of the many manifestations of the blood libel. And the innocent Jews had been dragged to the Tower of London before being bundled to Westminster, and 19 of them, quote, were on the same day drawn, and after the hour of dinner, towards the close of day, hanged, unquote. London got to have a front row seat to such mass judicial murder. Finally, 1256 comes along and Ralph Hardell was elected mayor for a third term, and it was hoped that maybe there would not be a clash this year. A forlorn hope, but a hope nevertheless, and it was entirely misplaced. This time, the row was tax evasion, and the offenders were London's wine merchants. We read, quote, in the same year, Henry de Bas, the justicar, came to the Guildhall in London, bringing to the mayor and sheriffs a writ from his lordship the king, who whereupon summoned before him all the vintners of the city, the justicar wishing to immerse all of these for breach of the assize of wine, unquote. Now, this was a bit of an escalation, and the Londoners pointed out to the justicar, well, quote, the citizens made answer that the vintners who had broken the assize ought, and are wont, solely to be immersed at the common pleas of the crown, and not before a justicar at the Tower, unquote. Yeah, like, seriously, did they need a king's justicar to rule on such a low, unimportant issue? And according to Justicar de Bar, going via a lesser court, quote, will not satisfy his lordship the king, for that it does not seem just or right that they may break the assize for 7 years or more with impunity and only once be immersed for so many offences, unquote. Yeah, yeah, apparently they were escalating this up. Cynical listeners could be forgiven for going, they're only doing this so they can get more cash out of London. But Londoners were able to fight back by pointing out the bleeding obvious, and that, quote, his lordship the king both is wont to and may, whenever he pleases, upon election by the citizens, appoint two wardens to keep that assize, in manner as hereforto. Such wardens being now dead, and the citizens having no precepts since for the election of others, that the same wardens too, when anyone is convicted of a breach of the assize, ought to sell the wine found in the tun, in reference to the which the breach has been committed, unquote. So yeah, the Londoners pointed out that any failure of the crown-appointed inspectors of wine for detecting what the wine merchants was up to was the responsibility of the crown-appointed inspectors of wine, and it was clear that the last one had died, and London could not appoint the crown-appointed inspectors of wine, as they were the crown-appointed inspectors of wine. And behind it all, the city was basically saying to the king's justicar, how is this our problem, mate? Luckily, the tactic seems to have worked. The records say, quote, at length, after much altercation had taken place, the matter was postponed for a conference whereon with the king, unquote. Thankfully, London seems to have escaped having to pay a fortune this time around. And yet, it was seemingly endless, an ongoing campaign of sniping and attacks upon the city and its liberty. The city also was a place where huge nation-changing events were witnessed. For example, we read in that year, quote, during Lenten and Easter week, there came several princes of Almaine to London, namely the Archbishop of Cologne and other bishops, dukes and counts, who all did homage to his lordship Earl Richard in presence of his lordship the king, his brother, they having elected him king, unquote. Yep, the Earl Richard of Cornwall, crusader and eager advocate of the king, was now chosen to be king of the Germans, and he left to take the throne over there. 1257 began with Ralph Hardell as mayor and the sheriffs Thomas FitzThomas and Robert de Cantigny in office. But then Robert de Cantigny died, and the steadfast and previous mayor of London, Matthew Bookerell, was appointed temporarily in his place. And in 1257, a couple of things went down. The first, well, if you can remember chapter 90, I explained the diminishing powers of London's merchants to control foreign trade in the city and mentioned the loss of the domination of the woad trade. It was all the way back in chapter 30, where I described that woad merchants from Normandy were forbidden to sell their wares except on the docks of London. Well, by January 1257, this centuries-long power was diminished. However, in February that year, something else happened really big. Out of the blue, the king really stepped up his attacks on London. The record of Arnulf FitzSiedmar claims that, quote, "A certain roll was found in the wardrobe of his lordship the king at Windsor, sealed with green wax, and placed there by some person unknown, in which were set forth many articles against the mayor, to the effect that the city had been aggrieved by him and his abettors beyond measure, as well as in respect of tallage as of other injuries that had been committed by them," unquote. This scroll, sealed with green wax, alleged London was guilty of various financial crimes against the crown. Now, there's a tradition found in later historians that said the scroll never even existed. The king had made up these accusations and then said, "Oh, these are not my beliefs. I just found this scroll in Windsor Castle that had them written on." Yeah, Henry, of course you did, mate. But regardless, the king ordered a full investigation and, quote, "Wherefore his lordship the king, wishing to know the truth, therefore, sent John Mansell to London, and had the folk moot summoned on the Sunday following, upon which day he had said roll read before all the people," unquote. John Mansell was the chief justice of the land, and he did not come alone, for with him when he read the scroll of the anonymous accusations were the Earl of Leicester, Henry de Bar, the judge who had tried to get London over a barrel when it came to the wine taxes, and several others of the Royal Council. They were here to launch a massive investigation of London. And that investigation was there to discover, quote, "whether the mayor and his advisers had appropriated anything out of the tallages to their own use, and further commanded all the aldermen early in the morning to summon their ward motes, and also commanded that each man of each ward should there, in the absence of their aldermen, choose from their number 36 men, who, before being tallaged, all of whom were on the same day about the first hour to appear at St. Paul's before him and the others of the King's Council, who should be sent thither." So, they didn't just hint that the mayor and the sheriffs were in on this. The king was going after the aldermen of London. And so what he was basically doing was summoning 36 residents to help. I suppose the best way to understand it was the royal justice was assembling a grand jury to help them investigate corruption in London. Quote, "And accordingly, so it was done. And these 36 men appearing in the morrow in the hall of the Bishop of London, in the presence of John Munsell and Henry Le Bar, Justicars, Henry Le Wegham, Chancellor, Philip Lovell, Treasurer, and others of the King's Council. The aforesaid John spoke and gave orders on behalf of his lordship the King that the persons should certify them upon said articles on oath," unquote. So, yeah, massive turnout, royal power. These are the biggest, most powerful men in the land. And they're asking this grand jury, these 36 London citizens, in whose name they're going to conduct this big investigation, to swear that they will stand by these men's investigations. Now, you'd think in the face of this much royal power, these regular residents would be intimidated, and maybe they were, but, quote, "they said that, according to the laws of the city, they ought not to make oath upon any inquest except when it was a question of life or limb or where land has been lost or gained," unquote. So yeah, the Londoners are saying, "No, we don't need to swear another oath, mate. We're not going to empower you to do this. We've already sworn an oath. To the king, that's enough, isn't it?" And the response to the 36 Londoners telling the judges, "You know, we don't actually need to swear any separate oaths, my lords," was, well, it was clear the judges got upset, because it goes on to say, quote, there was much altercation taking place between the Justicar and the citizens, unquote. But all of this meant that they were rowing over what they were supposed to swear, and as such, quote, nothing was done on that day, unquote. The next day, the judges tried to do the same in Guildhall, but, quote, the citizens again refused to agree to make oath in the Inquisition or aforesaid, unquote. They just refused to give their names to this investigation. It took the king turning up in Westminster in person, letting it be known he was bloody furious about this, and he'd summoned both Michael Tovey, the mayor who seemed to annoy him, and Adam de Basing, the mayor he seemed to have liked, and got them to return to these 36 Londoners and told them they had to swear the oath. But the king's anger was so intense that once again he seized control over London, and, quote, the mayor, sheriffs and king's chamberlain being removed, though no one of them had been in any way convicted, and then delivered into the custody of the constable of the Tower, unquote. And this done, the Chief Justice of the realm began his huge investigation into the books of London, searching the accounts for evidence of graft, fraud, and illegality. And there then followed several days of hot legal action. Now, I could go into incredible detail about this court case that followed, and my original plan was to spend an entire episode on this case alone. But the thing is, for all the eyewitness accounts of it being gripping, it really is fundamentally the Crown making a series of accusations and the residents of London constantly, endlessly finding rebuttals, retorts and explanations. And the King is in the background clearly having a temper tantrum every time some idea he proposed was thwarted, and then trying to change the settings from as they went to the court case being held in the Guildhall to it being trying to be held in the Folk Mooton. And at the end of it all, despite suspending the mayor, the sheriffs and all the aldermen, all they could find was six aldermen were guilty of not enforcing rules and measurements correctly and were removed from office. All of that. And that's all he got. Quote, whereupon all the aldermen, save and except the persons before mentioned, were restored to their bailiwicks. Also Thomas FitzThomas was restored to a sheriffwick, and William Greatfig was made sheriff in place of Matthew Buckerell. Unquote. So yeah, all that fuss, and nothing was really done. And while all this was happening, the walls of London were being restored, and the costs of restoring the rebuilding of the walls of London, of course, that was being charged to London. And those investigations into London just so happened to be taking place the same year. It was discovered that the guys appointed by the Crown to be in charge of rebuilding the walls were guilty of actual graft and corruption, which probably infuriated the Londoners. And if all of this wasn't enough, quote, in this year, there was a failure of the crops, upon which failure, a famine ensued, to such a degree that the people from the villages restored to the city for food. And there, upon the famine waxing still greater, many thousand persons perished. Many thousands more, too, would have died of hunger had not corn just then arrived from Germany, unquote. So picture the scene. London is filled with hordes of newcomers. The crop failure and famine across the island had driven thousands into London, and the city could barely cope. Hundreds of people are dying of starvation, the sickly sweet smell of emancipated bodies, bellies distended and afflicted by the lethargy of the starving, these permeated its streets. Had not food relief been shipped in from Cologne and other places, paid for probably by either the city fathers or by the Germanic merchants of the steelyards, thousands more would have died than did. And while all this is going on, the king is furiously launching massive investigations into the city, accusing it of crimes against the crown. And after all the nonsense, just a few aldermen had to be replaced in a couple of unnecessary by-elections. And then on top of this, the king was committing himself to a wild foreign policy move that threatened to cripple the whole nation financially. England, and above all, London, was at breaking point. A storm was about to explode. A political crisis unlike anything the city had ever seen before was about to be unleashed. And London was to be in the front row of what was to come. And that's all coming up in chapter 95 of The Story of London. Thanks for listening. Hope you could follow. Hope you could enjoy it. I know the last few chapters have been about the king did this, the king did that, the king. Yeah, when I started this, I was quite neutral about Henry III. You know, he's just a king. Now, what a git. Sorry, yeah. Go on, Simon and Mumford, kick his head in. Anyway, so that's my bias out of the way, and I think you should know it. If you like this podcast and you want to support it, please, if you feel so inclined, give us a 5-star rating or maybe even write a glowing review if you feel so inclined. On top of this, if you'd also like to support us, you can make a one-off donation at the Buy Me a Coffee webpage I've set up to accept donations. And if you want to go even further, you can become a member and support this podcast and just basically allow us cover the fees we needed to run for another month. So enough of me babbling on. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And I'll be back again next week. Chapter 95 is coming. We're nearly at 100. I can't believe it. See you then. Bye.